We're going to get started. I'm calling to order the Committee on Civil Law. We don't yet have a quorum, but we're going to get started with testimony. Unfortunately, Representative Lesh won't be here today, so I will be substitute. So first on the, we're going to go out of order on the agenda. We're going to take Representative Moline's bill first. So Representative Moline, does your bill need to go anywhere else? I guess it needs to go to Judiciary. So the chair will move House File 892 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee when I have a quorum. But if you could please describe your bill, Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I'm here to present House File 892, the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. And what House File 892 does is improves international recognition and enforcement of Minnesota child support orders. Members, some of you will recall that sometimes we do this on a, I guess, country-by-country basis. Last year we did one, I believe Representative Hoppe carried, so that Bermuda would recognize a Minnesota child support order. This bill simply makes it easier so we don't have to do it on a country-by-country basis, but so that internationally our Minnesota child support orders will be recognized. And with me I have Judge Harriet Lansing, who will be better able to explain the bill to you, so if she's able to provide her testimony.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair Hillstrom. I am Harriet Lansing, and I'm here as a Minnesota Uniform Law Commissioner to make a short presentation on House File 892, the revisions to the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. And I should also say that Julie Erickson from the Department of Human Services is also here this morning in case there are tough questions that I will need her support on. The original Uniform Interstate Family Support Act was enacted in Minnesota in 1994 as Chapter 518C of the Minnesota Statutes, and we're here this morning because we believe for two reasons that the Minnesota version now needs some updating. The first reason that Representative Moline explained is that the revisions will improve enforcement of Minnesota child support orders abroad. Currently, our international support orders operate as they did in the very early stages of our interstate child support under a reciprocity type structure. And although the United States uniformly tries to enforce child support orders that are issued by foreign jurisdictions, we don't always have that same reciprocity when we're working in other countries. So that is a good example about the Bermuda situation, where we're having to do it country by country, and that is one of the things that this act addresses. The United States worked to initiate and then ultimately signed in 2007 the Hague Convention on the International Recovery of Child Support and Other Forms of Family Maintenance. And this is the convention that this act works integrally to allow this structure for enforcement. So there's an estimated 150,000 international child support cases that currently involve a party in the United States who either seeks support or is owing support to a child. The structure incorporated in this convention is essentially the existing interstate family support laws that we have here. It just takes the these orderly procedures. It went through this convention at The Hague, and now we're back here trying to implement them to adjust to the global, essentially, movement of our residents. So we have the same principles, that principle of continuing exclusive jurisdiction, registration of orders, and initiating and responding tribunals that is now going to be extended to on an international basis. So amending Minnesota's Family Support Act will improve enforcement of Minnesota child support orders abroad, help ensure that citizens and children residing in Minnesota will receive the financial support that they need. And then the second reason is for the clarification of various rules that came out of a 2001 amendment in the uniform laws. So the remaining question is, why should we do it now? And first, because Minnesota's continued collection of federal child support under Section 4D is going to be conditioned ultimately by enacting these amendments in the same way that the 1996 federal legislation required enactment of the existing provisions of the Interstate Family Support Act. And that is a rather substantial amount of money, as I'm sure you're aware. The amount of 4D funding distributed to Minnesota has exceeded $100 million since 2006, and in 2012 it was roughly $104,778,000. So Minnesota will have a short grace period to comply after the federal legislation is in place, and the federal legislation has been it was introduced in the House passed by the House last June, but not by the Senate. And we now have a new Congress that will have to be reintroduced. But the legislation was introduced in the U.S. Senate on March 7th. So Senator Menendez has introduced it with a co-author of Senator Grassley. So it's in process. Second, Minnesota's authority over child support issues will be preserved. We're trying here to maintain the historical positions of the state to ensure that their processes are the ones that are being implemented when we go internationally with these types of agreements. And finally, we think that Minnesota should do it now because we think that we've got this pulled together and we're ready to go, that the necessary changes have been worked through, that the Revisor's Office has fine-tuned the changes. The Minnesota State Bar Association and the American Bar Association endorse the act, and the delayed effective date aligns with the federal legislation. 10 other states have already done this, and it has been introduced in 4 or 5 other ones in the 2013 session. So that concludes my remarks. I'm happy to try to answer questions.
Thank you. Members, we currently have a quorum, so I will officially call the civil law meeting to order. And then I will officially move that House File 892 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. Are there questions from members? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got a comment and then a question. First comment is, you made the statement that we should, you know, there's a whole ton of federal dollars tied to this, and I guess I would be of an opinion that we should do things because it's good legislation, not because there's federal dollars tied and a string tied to something. The other thing I think is important, that the federal legislation that I understand what you said is that the federal legislation hasn't been enacted yet. And as it goes through its process, just like it does here, many times it's amended. And what I'm afraid we're doing is we're getting the cart in front of the horse, and we should wait until that legislation comes through so we don't have to revisit this thing and make amendments to it again, because our time here and our process here, as everybody has been feeling the pain, sometimes gets a little overwhelming. So I would prefer that we wait until the federal inaction happens and then follow suit so we don't have to revisit this thing time and time again as they make adjustments. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Huff. Further questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Milleen, I would very much appreciate a response to Representative Howe's question. I think that's a really good point, and given the way things happen on a national basis, I'm just wondering what your response is to that.
Representative Milleen.
Madam Chair and Representative Pugh, considering the way things happen on a national basis, I don't know as a state if we should always sit around and wait for the federal government to act. But I think that Judge Lansing would be able to better answer that question.
Judge Lansing.
Chair Hillstrom, Representative Pugh, and Representative Howe. first of all, in terms of whether we should do this for its own reasons and not because of the conditional spending of the federal government, I completely agree. The Uniform Law Commission is very tied to the idea of doing acts for the validity and the value of the acts themselves and the integrity of those acts. The reason that I integrate that concept is only on the basis of notice, not to mention it, I think, would be an oversight. So I want you to know that it is tied in that respect. And in terms of whether we should do it now or wait, those are considerations, you know, that I understand and respect. But I think that we have an act that is essentially taken from our state child support structure. And so almost all of the pieces of this act are part of this ongoing structure that we've had in place in states for a very long time. So when the federal legislation is essentially tied to the concepts of ratification and of the treaty, the Hague Convention. And so it's those concepts that they are working on, not the integral parts of this act. And it's something that we really won't have much capacity to influence because that is under the federal treaty power. So I think it's important for states to act because essentially the way this Hague Convention is being ratified is through state enactments. Once all the states have enacted these revisions that take into account the international, that is essentially the process of ratifying this treaty. So then the documents will be deposited by the federal government to demonstrate that it has been ratified. So I think that it is important that we do it now because we have all of this pulled together. Is there a possibility that there might be some amendments? The answer to that is yes. But I don't think those amendments will be global or overwhelming. And I think as the other 10 states have done and the other states that are considering it now in this session, that this is the best time to put it forward.
Other questions from members? All right, seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 892 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Nay.
Motion prevailed. Thank you, Representative Moline. Next, we have Representative Nelson. So the chair will move that House File 844 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Labor, Workplace, and Regulated Industry. Welcome to the committee, Representative Nelson. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 844, we're here today to talk about two provisions in this bill that will improve access to quality home care services in Minnesota. A voluntary registry of home care workers to help match clients with prospective workers and the creation of the Department of Health and Human Services in the Department of Health and Services, Human Services, a list of home care workers only for the use of new DHS Advisory Council and for possible representation purposes. The first item, the public registry of home care workers, starts on page 6 of the bill on lines 20 through 31, and it is a voluntary opt-in through which home care workers hang out a shingle. Right? But more importantly, it will serve as a way for looking for home care services to find a nearby available worker with the qualifications they require. Through this registry, which will operate similar to many other websites the state maintains for people to find nearby health services, those looking for services will have the resources to go to when their immediate networks of family and friends does not suffice. To be clear, page 2, lines 3 through 14 guarantee that the clients will not be required to use this registry to find their home care workers. In other words, they can still hire whomever they wish, whether on the registry or off. The second item for discussion is the list of DHS will create of home care workers on page 7, lines 14 through 23. Specifically, those in the self-directed programs where the client selects, hires, directs, and can terminate the employment of their specific home care worker or workers. This bill does not affect those workers who are hired directly by private agencies.
Excuse me, Representative Nelson. You're referencing a page 7. We don't have a page 7. Are you working off a different document?
I'm working on the 844, the first engrossment.
We have this introduced.
Okay. Representative Nelson, we have the previous version in the packet, so while your testimony continues to go on, staff will go get the first engrossment.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Please continue.
Again, it's line 7, it's 14 through 23, and it's, where was I at? The bill does not affect those workers who are hired directly by private agencies. In order to stabilize the home care workforce, which sees as much as a 50% turnover in a given year, and to attract more people to a field with growing demand at our state as our state ages, my bill will create a workforce council to advise DHS on how to implore quality and access to self and directed home care services that would allow workers to choose to form a union, and if they do so, to bargain with the state over wages and benefits. Both of these functions require DHS to create a list of workers for the use by the council in advising DHS, and for use by the exclusive representatives, if they're chosen, to facilitate the representational process. This workforce is different than many others in that there is no single workplace, and the place to work is explicitly the home of their client receiving services through medical assistance. As a result, the list created by my bill would be of home care workers themselves in self-directed programs, along with their home addresses to protect the data privacy of their clients. Again, repeat, it's going to be of the home care workers themselves, not the workplace. You will note on lines 17 and 18 that the list shall not include the names of any participant or indicate that an individual provider is a relative or a participant of a participant or has the same address as a participant. We want to protect the privacy of the patients. This list will allow the Workforce Council to track information like workforce stability, the geographic distribution, as well as allowing workers through their exclusive representatives to speak with fellow home care workers about their common interests and potential interest of forming a union. Page 2, lines 25 through 31, lays out the process by which 500 workers can make a showing of interest that allows the exclusive representative to receive this list from DHS. This process is an additional protection not currently in PELRA. I would like to have now have a recipient of private or home health care services, Ziggy Norberg, speak to this issue on his behalf and on behalf of his home care worker, which is his mother.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Ziggy Norberg. I'm a college student, a champion kayaker, and a basketball player. I rely on the support of my personal care attendant in order to remain active in my community and meet my goals. I understand that this committee is considering how the state could provide a list of home care workers without violating my privacy or the privacy of other people who receive home care services. My mom is my PCA. I hired her because we live in the same house and she knows me better than anyone. Neither of us is at all concerned about the state providing her name and address to a workforce council or to a group of workers organizing a union. This won't affect us at all. The bill already protects my privacy by stating that any list won't include the name of any participant. My mom could have chosen to pursue a career where she could make more money or have access to benefits. Instead, she chose to work for me. Now, my mom wants the right to form a union with other home care workers. She works hard and she deserves the same rights as any other workers. The list will allow my mom and other home care workers to talk to one another to discover their common interests and the similar problems they face in this industry, such as low wages and no access to benefits like health care. Home care workers need to be able to connect with one another to discuss how best to improve services for people like me, and to improve conditions for workers. I support home care workers' right to form a union. I know that my mom won't be able to work for me forever. When the day finally comes that I might need to find someone else, I want to be rest assured that I'll be able to find someone who takes the job seriously like my mom does. Please support this bill for me, my mom, and my community. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
That's all I have. If there's any questions.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kara Benson, and I'm a program director at AcroCare. I am here to oppose House File 844, specifically the portion regarding unionization and the entire entire personal care assistance and consumer-directed community support workforce, irrespective of employer circumstance. AcroCare helps recipients set up their PCA choice services. AcroCare performs the necessary background check on the PCA. The qualified professional works with the recipient and their PCAs to develop a care plan. AcroCare submits all paperwork and billing to the state and provides the PCA's payroll. We employ approximately 2,600 PCA choice workers across the state of Minnesota. Their average wage at our agency is $12.35 per hour. Even though the individual or their representative selects the worker, AcroCare is the employer, not the state. This legislation creates a great deal of uncertainty for recipients, forces family members to join a union in order to receive a care entitlement, and creates more paperwork and costs for businesses like AcroCare. We have you to get a rate increase for home and community-based services. A union is not needed. This bill does not grant the potential union striking power. It only grants exclusive negotiations with the state, but those negotiations are not binding. The union can reach an agreement with MMB, and due to budget constraints, the legislature can vote that agreement down and establish a new pay rate for PCAs in exactly the same way it is done today. The union can then go to binding arbitration, which again can be voted down by this legislature. PCAs are important people in our society. The work is not easy. They deserve respect and to get the best rate for their hard work. I know some of you on this committee have supported a bill to increase home and community-based service rates by 5%. Thank you for doing that. That increase will be passed on to the direct care workers, including PCAs, who do this important work. If you pass this bill to unionize self-directed workers, those employees will need to pay union dues, taking away from the increase they so deserve. This bill has too many questions and not enough answers. Does a son caring for his sick mother 10 hours a week need to pay union dues? Will a parent no longer be allowed to take an entitlement without joining a union? This bill also leaves much about its training requirements unknown. Who provides and pays for this training? How long would the training take? Would this training cause delay in a family member providing care services to their parent or child, thus taking away the recipient's preference for their caregiver? Will the training requirements exclude certain people, non-English-speaking individuals, from doing this important work? Will the training be verified through state licensing? How is the state going to pay for this training, and what is the fiscal note? Finally, when talking about consumer-directed community support services, creating a union wage through the state eliminates all flexibility. A woman with MS will no longer be able to pay her daughter minimum wage to sit with her in the evening and pay an experienced qualified worker to help her during the day. The overall budget is not increasing. That, members of the committee, goes against everything the self-directed model seeks to create. I urge you to take time to see how this will impact services for people before passing this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify? I thought I saw two hands. All right, please come to the table. State your name for the record.
My name is Lisa Camper, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I am with Consumer Directions, a fiscal support entity certified by DHS to provide administrative and payroll support to families when they choose to employ their own workers. We serve approximately 650 individuals who are self-directing their services under CDCS, Consumer Directed Community Supports. I've been an advocate of this model since it began in Minnesota. I am here to testify today because I oppose how this bill confuses the facts by grouping Consumer Directed Community Supports with PCA Choice. These are separate programs and separate workforces. This bill takes away the core and fundamental principles of the CDCS participant being able to have the flexibility to set and determine wages. Here are the successes resulting from participant control over staff compensation and employment. The average wage for a CDCS worker is $13.26 an hour. This is actual data compiled by a collaboration of FSEs as of March 4, 2013. Additionally, we know that the average length of tenure in CDCS is 34 months, and 35% have worked 5 years or longer. 87.6% of this workforce is comprised of family and friends. These workers are predominantly doing this out of a labor of love, not in pursuit of a career in caregiving. This leads me to concerns. Will an older sister, brother, cousin, aunt, uncle, grandparent, parent have to join a union to provide care to a loved one? CDCS is an evidence-based program that is working. These statistics do not support the need for a collective bargaining unit for these CDCS workers, as these statistics show that there is already a reliable, accessible, trained workforce of trusted caregivers with a low rate of staff turnover who are receiving better wages. Did you know that half of the people we serve under CDCS are set up as household domestic employers and that they directly hire their employees under their own employer identification number? The IRS has recognized these employers as home health care service recipients. Under the definition in the National Labor Relations Act, any individual employed in the domestic service of any family or person in their home, or any individual employed by a parent or a spouse, is exempt. Please separate these workforces and consider amending this bill to exclude participants who are household domestic employers. I would also like to address the elephant in the room, union dues. No one seems to know what this amount is going to be. But for simplicity, let's just say it's $10 a month, not a large number. $120 a year still doesn't seem like a very large number. But we estimate this to affect approximately 30,000 people. When I do that math, that's $3.6 million of state and federal Medicaid dollars being taken away from our clients and given to the union, SEIU, to help fix something that is not broken. Our clients are not okay with this, and you should not be okay with this, and I, as a taxpayer, am not okay with this. In closing, I would like to think that we all have a shared value in supporting the philosophy of self-direction and the resulting fiscal savings that consumer-directed community supports provides. And with that, we are committed and willing to work with the author so that this bill does not lose the viability of self-direction in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And nothing in this bill, and we're not discussing those parts, at least I don't believe we're discussing those parts today. We're discussing the creating the list. But nothing in this bill requires anyone to join a union. All this bill does is give the people, the personal care attendants, who are do not work for an agency, and the first testifier works for an agency, they're not covered under this bill. but anyone that does not work for an agency the ability to meet together and form and join a union, if they choose. If they do that, it's going to go through the normal process of forming a union, which is they're going to get cards signed to get show interest. Then they're going to hold an election where all the people that are covered by PCA, as PCAs, would be able to vote whether they want a union or not. And this is what it's about, is allowing these people to have a choice to vote and again, with through self-direction, choose whether they want a union or not. Then that's what the bill does. But the parts here about the list, the first lady that talked about with the from AccuCare, they currently, because they're an employer, those people that work there currently have that ability to form and create a union in their workplace. So they're not even covered by this bill.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. We actually have some questions. Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is actually for Mr. Norberg, if he can come back up.
Thank you.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you. Mr. Norberg, currently we know your mom is your PCA. How many years older than you is your mom?
Mr. Norberg.
Approximately.
20 plus years older.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Mr. Norberg. If anything should happen to your mom, or if you should, as we would normally expect, outlive your mom, you'll have to find a new PCA.
That is correct.
Do you think this is the establishment of this list would help that, and how?
Mr. Norberg.
Absolutely, I think it would help. Having this list and having the ability to know, you know, where the workers are, what sort of qualifications they have, would really help, you know, me find a worker once my mom is no longer able to be my worker, because right now you're really just relying on people you know or word of mouth or just placing a random ad out in the classifieds, and I don't think that's really the way to get quality care.
Thank you. Representative Yarusso.
Thank you. That's all I had from
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, I was late, and I apologize to you and the committee if I'm going over ground that you've already covered in detail. But in terms of just the list here, which is technically the reason it's before us, so my understanding is that that the list would not list the employer at all, right? I'm sorry, it wouldn't list the address or the information to contact that person at the employer. Is that correct?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, no, the list would not list the address of the employer, and if the PCA lives with the employer, it wouldn't designate that either. It was just going to list the names and the addresses of the employees.
Representative Scott. Representative Simon.
Yeah, just to follow up. So how does the process start to begin with? An example, I don't want to make it about my family, but let me just give you an example that I know about, which is my family. So my father has 24-hour supervision. And there are about four people who cycle in and out, and my sister and I handle all that, and they work for him. They're not part of an agency. How would they even know to be part of this? Would they? I'm not sure how the process starts with them, or are they just outside the scope of this bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Simon, it's through a normal organizing drive by a union or somebody that wants to form a union. Once they get a certain number of people. In the case of the bill, it says 500 people that are interested. They would get access to the list that's created by the Department of Health of these employees, and then they'd be able to contact them at their homes and to talk to them and find out if there is an interest. And once they get enough interest, then they can ask for an election and have an election. And these people would also get mailings from the union stating that this is what we're trying to do, be invited to participate. That's how they'd be notified. And that's why we're feeding the names of the employees, not the employer. In a typical workplace where you have a single place where everybody works, that could be done right on the workplace, and people could talk back and forth between at lunch and talk back and forth. But in the situation here where they work in all corners of the state of Minnesota, this is the way that they have to get access to discussing these things between one another.
Certainly. So I represent Simon, then I'll have Scott, and then I'll have Hal. So represent Simon.
Yeah, so just to follow up. So in other words, there's not going to be mail coming to, in the example I just gave you, there's not going to be mail coming to my father's place or phone calls coming to my father's place about unionization.
Representative Nelson.
That's correct. Unless it was you taking care of it or somebody living with him and that was their home address.
Right. Okay. Thanks.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would the CDCS fiscal support entities now be required to report to DHS who the providers are?
Representative Nelson?
I didn't understand that question. The question.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would the CDCS fiscal support entities now be required to report to DHS who their providers are?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, no, they would not. I believe that information may already be part of what DHS has, but no, they would not be this bill would not require them to do that.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what protections do you have in this bill in case this data is misused, if it's handed down, say, for political purposes?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I think that's covered under our current law with data privacy, and I believe Representative Holberg is probably the expert on that, but that would be covered under current law, current penalties.
Representative Scott.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
We can come back to you if we can go to Representative Howe.
Yeah, go ahead.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I'm questioning when I'm going to follow up on Representative Simon's question. How they're going to make a drive to get folks, whether can't they do that now? Why do we need legislation to create a list of folks? Can't they, if they choose to join a union or choose to organize, what prohibits them from organizing now? How do they draw? Why do we need legislation to create a list?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, currently there is no list available of these people, and the list isn't just for the organization drive. If the union does their drive and it fails, these people, this list would also help other people that need the help of a personal care attendant to be able to have access to other people in their area that provide this service. So in the case of Ziggy, if his mother could no longer provide that service, he would be able to access this list to find someone that lives near his home that could do that service for him. And that's what the list is about. That's the main purpose of the list. And the other purpose of the list is so this workplace council can communicate and discuss with these people and talk about ways that they can improve training and things that they need to make their profession better. And I believe I have a gentleman here that may be able to expound on the answer.
State your name for the record and go ahead. Members, we're going to try to vote on this bill within the next 5 minutes or so. So go ahead, state your name.
Madam Chair, members of this committee, my name is David Zaffron. I'm a public policy specialist with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. To the representative's question, this group of workers does not have the right to form a union because they're employed directly by the people that they care for as individual providers of these services. People who are part of the workforce of a private provider agency do have the right to form a union under the National Labor Relations Act. Those people who are working in these programs and self-directed home care programs are hired and work for the people that they care for, and that is why they do not have the right to form a union.
Follow up, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, if they don't have a right to form a union, who are they going to be employed by after this list is created? Does that mean they're going to be state employees and covered under PELRA?
Representative Nelson.
They're going to have limited coverage under PELRA, and just for the purpose of being able to form the union, if they choose to do that, they'll be considered state employees. And actually, I've seen some things that because the state of Minnesota currently, the ones that are in personal care attendance, currently withholds taxes and from them, and that gives them a nexus as being the employer.
We're getting pretty far afield of the list, Representative Powell.
I just thank
it is Manager. Going to workforce next. So, Representative Powell.
I guess then the next question I got is the basic question. Who has had the problem, I guess, in finding their PCAs? Did someone that had a problem finding a PCA bring this to you, or who brought this issue to you to bring this legislation forward?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, it was brought to me by personal care attendants. Actually, at our town meetings that we've had, there's been a personal care attendant that has come to my town meetings that talked to us about this. But the union that has been approached about this has brought the legislation to me that they're interested in doing this to create, so they can have these people have the ability to try and form a union. And again, there's no guarantee. This does not create a union. This does not guarantee a union. This only gives these people the ability to do the work necessary to try and get to an election, and then all the PCAs across the state will have the chance to vote and vote on whether they want to form a union or not.
Okay, so I have questions from Representative Pugh, Neuberger, and Holberg. So, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, my first question, and it's really a comment, I'm assuming that there wouldn't be a cost to register to add one's name to this registry.
Representative Nelson.
There's no cost currently, Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, there is no cost currently in this, but what happens in future years with the Department of Health and Human Services, I have no control over that. It would be a voluntary registration.
Representative Pugh.
Okay, thank you. And my second question is in response to a comment that you made about that this bill does not affect those individuals hired by, I believe, a private entity.
Agencies.
An agency, thank you. And so what my question is specifically, does this preclude employees that are hired by an agency from participating? You know, should those employees be interested in doing work outside of the contract that they may have with their agency?
Representative Nelson.
Representative Hillstrom, Chair Hillstrom, and Representative Pugh, no, it does not preclude them from voluntarily joining the union, mm-hmm. if they choose.
Okay,
thank
you. And I think my last question is if and or when a vote for a unionization of this group of individuals occurs, who would be included in that vote? How would that occur? Would it be limited to specifically those individuals registered through this new entity?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, no, it would not. The only people who would be excluded from it were the people that are currently working for agencies, but it's individuals that work for personal care attendants that works for personal patients would be included.
So Representative Neuberger's on the list next. Then we're going to go to Representative Holberg, and we're going to vote in a few minutes. So Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question. So if these folks unionize, you have this list of all your union members, and they're making between $10 and $13 an hour, I would assume that the very first demand that they're going to have is they're going to probably want a wage increase. If that occurs and that doesn't happen, then they go on strike. Now you're going to put these people in a very strange dilemma. If I go on strike, then I don't take care of grandma. I can't get my head around that one. You got these one-on-one relationships, and where are you going to find replacement workers? And let's just go down that whole path. I mean, there's a proven path of how this whole thing would work out. And so if I go on strike, now I don't take care of grandma? Is that what happens?
Well, Representative Neuberger, I am confident they will be talking about that in Labor and Workforce Development. If you have a question about the data provisions, we're going to vote here in a few minutes. So Representative Neuberger.
Correct. The data provisions was...
Madam Chair, if I can alleviate it, if you look on page 2.19, individuals, providers, subject to this bill, are not allowed to strike. and that is something the personal care attendants themselves have asked for to be in the bill. They do not want to go on strike, simply basically for the reasons you suggested, that there takes, in many cases, they're taking care of grandma or they're taking care of a family member, and they don't want to be forced to go on strike. They're going to be considered essential employees.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nelson, for purpose of discussion, if we're talking about the list, this is the list compiled by the Department of all active personal care employees as of July 1st, 2013, and the registry would be an individual opt-in to people that wanted to be part of a public list. Is that correct?
Representative Nelson.
Representative Holberg, Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
And I'm a little confused. How do you get the first 500 names? How does that work?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I believe, and Representative Holberg, I believe that would come from people that have currently contacted the union to say that they're interested in this, and that's how they would get the first 500 people. And once they get 500 people that say they want to do this that are personal care attendants, that then they'd have access to the list to contact
Holberg.
The rest of them.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, and Representative Nelson, I see some correlation to the daycare provider unionization process. However, something's very different in that right now licensed daycare providers, their information is public. So for those individuals that oppose this, they have the ability to communicate with the same universe of people, if you will. Under your bill, if you're not a union, will you have access to the list of people that work as PCAs?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I believe the answer to that is, I'm being told no.
Representative Holberg.
And Madam Chair, I think that's not really a very fair playing field, that if, in fact, there's going to be a process to only allow one entity to communicate with this list of people, doesn't even quite seem fair to me. I think that's something that, you know, should be looked at, that if I am a personal care attendant opposed to unionization, like I said, in the case of the daycare providers, they're able to find out who else is in that pool, if you will, and communicate and talk and evaluate pros and cons. There doesn't appear, if that list is only available to the unions, there's not the ability to have even a fair playing field. So I think that's really very problematic. It may, in fact, I don't know if there's a way around it, and maybe not all personal care attendants want to be part of a public list. If you're hearing that 87% of them are family members and trying to do a good thing, and I think many of them do it not for the money but to make sure that they're taking good care of a family member or a friend, I think your process is maybe, from some perspectives, not fair because only one group gets the list, but you're also going to, I don't know if it makes sense, or maybe it's more fair to have the department make an initial contact of all the people working in this field and ask them to opt into a list, or have them provide a full range of information, rights, responsibilities, etc. I'm just concerned that the universe of who you're talking to, that it should be a fair process. And then I just, for clarification's sake, there was a question about whether or not the employees that worked for an organization would sign up for this list, and you said no, the department would already have their names. So would that initial list comprised by the department include the names of personal care attendants that were working for agencies?
Representative Nelson.
I'm not sure. And I'll have to say, I'm not sure on that question, and I'll get back to you and get the answer, but I'm not sure.
Members, well, I've already said that we were going to vote about, I don't know, 8 minutes ago or so. Representative Holberg, if you have one final question, then we're going to go to the vote.
And Chair, I'd be willing to work with Representative Holberg. I know she's one of what I consider an expert on data privacy, and that's part of the reason why it's in the we're trying to protect the data privacy of the patients that are receiving this care. So that's why there are some restrictions there. But I would be willing to work with Representative Holberg to, if there are things we can work on.
And Representative Madam Holberg. Chair, I'm not just concerned about the patients, and I certainly am concerned about those, but with the, I'm not familiar with this field, but with the testimony of it being 87% are family members or friends, I'm just really concerned. But without having some sunshine or public access to the list, if you only give it to the union organizers, you really have not set up a fair playing field for making this decision.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. All right, members, we're going to vote. The chair renews her motion that House File 844 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Labor, Workplace, and Regulated Industry. All those in favor?
Madam Chair, I'd like to have a roll call, please.
Representative Scott requests a roll call. The clerk will call the roll. Aye.
Vice Chair Ellen.
Aye.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Portman.
Aye.
Representative Howe.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Newberger.
No.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Pugh.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
No.
Representative Simon.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Winkler.
Yes.
Representative DeRusso.
Yes.
The bill does not pass. Ties 8-8.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
That's right. You know why.
Yes, Paul, Representative Rosenthal, sorry.
Representative Nelson, I agree with a lot of what Representative Holberg talked about, so I hope you do work with her and with anybody else bringing us forward, but I'd like to change my vote from no to aye.
Representative Rosenthal changes his vote from no to aye.
Madam Chair, roll call,
Representative
please.
Holberg. Representative Holberg is, Representative Rosenthal will make a motion to reconsider the vote by which this failed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do make a motion to reconsider the vote that failed.
All right, and Representative Holberg requests a roll call to pass the to reconsider the motion that failed.
Madam Chair, so just, can you maybe just explain that rule a little bit? I know sometimes there's a little confusion about what, you know, who's on the prevailing side, if that is applicable.
No,
if that's applicable in committee, sometimes on the House floor, I know the rule is different, but sometimes in conference committee or in. Trying to get to the bottom of it, Representative Scott.
Representative Scott. Representative Paymar.
Could you just explain how that rule is different on the House floor as opposed to a committee?
Certainly. Members, when you're on the House floor, you have to have voted on the prevailing side in order to make a motion to reconsider. That rule does not apply in committee. Any member can make a motion to reconsider in committee. And so we will have that motion to reconsider. We will take the vote. Representative Holt has requested a roll call.
Okay, sorry.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Madam Chair, I was going to ask this question before, but we may have some time now. Representative Holberg raised the point that only the organizers can get access to this list that is created. And as I read the bill, I don't see why that's the case. But I wonder if Representative Nelson or his testifier could explain why only this group gets this access to this list. As I see it, it looks like this council receives it. And I'm not sure where it says that they can give it only to one organization or one group in order to use it.
Mm-hmm. Members, we're not going to, I apologize to say that, but we're not going to rehash, because I had Representative Pugh who wanted to ask additional questions. I had other members who really wanted to ask additional questions. So.
He's right. What do you say?
Okay. So we're just going to take the vote on reconsideration.
Madam Chair,
Representative Hamer.
So we take the vote on. Do we vote on reconsideration, and then we'll take. Then we'll have the roll call vote.
That's correct, Representative Hamer. So first we'll make the motion on whether or not to reconsider the bill. Then we're going to again have a motion to pass the bill, and the motion will. Then be, I assume, have a roll call again, and we will re-roll call the vote.
Yes, Madam Chair, I wanted a roll call on the vote to reconsider.
That's correct, Representative Holberg. That's what I thought I said, that we're going to have a roll call on the motion to reconsider. Okay? All right. So with that, on the motion made to reconsider the bill, or the motion to reconsider the motion by where the bill failed on a tie, and the clerk will call the roll.
Chair Hirschfeld.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ellen.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Portman.
Aye.
Representative Howe.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling. Representative Neuberger.
No.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Pugh.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Winkler.
Yes.
Representative Yaruso.
Yes.
Okay, members, the motion passed to reconsider the vote whereby the bill failed. The eight voted in favor of reconsideration, seven voted no. So that motion prevails. So, members, back on to the motion to pass House File 844. It has not been amended. The motion is to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Labor, Workplace, and Regulated Industry. Is that correct, Representative Nelson?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And right. Roll call, Madam Chair.
And Representative Scott and Representative Holberg have both requested a roll call on this vote. Any more procedural questions? Okay. So good. All right. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nostrom.
Aye.
Vice Chair Ellen.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Portman.
Aye.
Representative Howe.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Neuberger.
Nope.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Pugh.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Winkler.
Yes.
Representative Yaruso.
Yes.
With 9-7, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Representative Leginius, are you in the room?
Yes.
Oh, Thank you. Members, there was, a wrong copy of the bill that was put in the folder. There's currently a copy being passed out of Representative Wagenius's bill. It is the engrossed copy. So where's this going? Okay. The chair moves that House File 1175 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. And Representative Wagenius, it's my understanding that you have the A9 amendment that is yours.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
So we're going to wait till all the members have the new bill and the A9 amendment before we move on that. Representative Wagenius. All right. All the members having the new House File 1175 and the A9 amendment, the chair will move the A9 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is a bill from the Department of Agriculture for a water quality certification program. I call your attention to page 4 for the certification that we just did, and data on line 4.26, and that's why we're before this committee. But I would like Assistant Commissioner Matt Wollman, who's sitting with me, to give you a very brief overview of what this bill is about. And then we have those two issues before you.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. So please state your name for the record, but please, you know, be brief about telling us about what the bill is about, and then, you know, focus on the issues that are before the committee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Matt Wollman. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. The Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program is a result of a historic memorandum of understanding that was signed in January of 2012 by Governor Mark Dayton, as well as Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack and EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson. It's, as I mentioned before, a new and exciting program that would develop a voluntary approach to enhancing water quality here in Minnesota. It would help to maintain farm profitability, but also enhance the quality of our waters in the state, recognize farmers who are doing a good job, and provide the assurance to the public and certainty that this enhancement is happening. And so thank you, Madam Chair. That's a brief overview.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We come to this committee because of the data practices on 4.26, and for the amendment that we just did, which clears up a question of a future legislature having jurisdiction to change this program, and we didn't want that to happen. So those are the two things that we came here for, and I'd be glad to answer questions or to have the Department of Agriculture staff answer questions.
Okay, before we have questions, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none. Questions from members. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wagenius, so it says it's going to be classified as either non-public or private. Why is there an either or there? Why wasn't it narrowed down to either Subdivision 9 or Subdivision 12.
Representative Wagenius.
I think we're going to have...
phone a friend. Come on down. Pull up a chair.
I think the attorney for the department is here.
Madam Chair, if I might...
Representative Holberg.
Non-public has to do with non-individual based information, so that would be information about location, whatever, I mean, maybe what equipment or... if it's information on individuals, it's public, private, or confidential. If it's information on non-individuals, then that's where you get that non-public classification.
Representative Scott.
Thank you.
All right. Thank
Very
you.
Very nice friend.
Thank you. Other questions from members? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Wagenius, given the classifications under Section 9, is it your intent that only the commissioner would have access to that information in the department? I see this involves a number of organizations, PCA, DNR, Bowser.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes.
So
Representative Holbrook.
Madam Chair, in other words, you would not be sharing it with Bowser. You would not be sharing it with any of the others. So only the Commissioner PCA is the one that holds the information?
Representative Wagenius.
I think that line 4.29 settles that issue. The Commissioner of Agriculture, and this is the Commissioner of Agriculture, shall make available summary data, so he has control over the data.
Representative Holberg.
All right, Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure that they didn't inadvertently. So only summary data will be available to the other agencies.
That's Representative Wagenius.
And then, Madam Chair, if I might, I'm not familiar with how somebody might receive a monetary benefit under page 4, lines 4, 5, 6. How would that be determined, and what records would the commissioner be able to access to determine that?
Representative Wagenius.
I think I'm going to ask Mr. Wolven to answer that.
Madam Chair, the only monetary benefit that a producer would receive would be cost share. So they would apply for cost share through this program to Bowser or through NRCS, just like they would normally apply for cost share for conservation practices.
Representative Holberg.
And Madam Chair, you might want to more clearly define that. There can be all kinds of monetary benefits outside. You know, if you're talking about getting grant money back, then maybe you should say that.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Well, if it needs clarifying, I'm glad to do it.
Further questions from members? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is probably me reading into it, but if you're going to have a hearing process in that 4.7, 4.8, does that not then make that data public?
Representative Wagenius.
Mr. Wolman is going to answer that.
Is it Wolberg? Is that your last name?
Question.
On here, does that make it the data public? Through a hearing process. Do we want to ask? I think we need to ask the attorney for the Department of Agriculture. I don't want to misstate this.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Doug Spanier. I'm the attorney at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
And we're looking here at this.
Right.
Do you want to repeat the question?
Yes.
The question is we're talking about the privacy of data, but yet the commissioner, when he's going to revoke a certification, it's got to go through a hearing process. Does that not make that data public?
State your name for the record.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my name is Doug Spanier, again, attorney with the Minnesota Department of Ag. I believe, I guess we will have to, if we bring it to a hearing, the information is protected up until the hearing. My guess is, I guess I'm not sure what happens to private data once it goes to that hearing. Once it's public in that hearing, I suppose it would be public. I would have to do some checking, though, with iPad to make sure. I honestly don't know that exact answer.
Representative Holberg, do you know the answer to that question? Representative Holberg.
I think it may be more complex. I don't want to weigh in.
Okay.
Yeah. But I do have another question, if I might, real briefly.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you. Going back to the grant, generally we like the grant distribution of public money to be public so that there's some accountability there. Will these monetary advantages referenced at the top of page 4 only go to people that have this certification? And will we then lose the ability to know who's getting money for this program?
I don't think that's the case, but I'm going to confirm that. But these are generally federal dollars that go out under the EQIP program. So the normal process will be followed.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Holberg.
I don't really care about the normal process. I'm trying to figure out is if you're giving grant money to these people as by virtue of the fact that they're going to have this certification, and grant recipients are public,
yes,
but
it should be public.
The certification process is not. I'm not sure you're really private. So
I think someone said that iPad is here. Yeah. Will they help or no?
Well, Madam Chair, perhaps I could explain a little bit.
Could you say your last name again? Your last name?
My name is Matt Warman. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Ag.
Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, the data that we're concerned about here is the data that will be collected through a measurement tool.
Yeah.
So we will be going out to the farm to work with producers to look at the kinds of practices that they have on their farm. So it's individual business practices that would be on the farm. And we would aggregate that data in such a way and calculate it to come up with an index to determine whether they're eligible to be certified under this program. Now, in regards to your question regarding grant dollars and so forth, the normal process that the state would use or the federal government would use in regards to program dollars would continue to be followed. But in terms of the certification, determining whether the state should put its full faith and credit behind this stamp of certification, that's where the data needs to be held private. And that is is consistent with the conservation programs under the Farm Bill provision.
And Madam Chair, maybe
Representative
I can
Holberg.
Simplify this. Do you know if grant recipients are public under federal and state standards for this program?
As far as I know,
Ms. Representative Wagenius.
Yes.
And Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, if I might then, if we are making their names public as a component of them being grant recipients, making everything, including their name, private under the certification seems kind of silly. And so if you might want to instead figure out what's public and should be public because they're grant recipients, and then maybe identify those more sensitive data sets that you don't think have a purpose in the public realm and identify those data sets to remain private or non-public.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I agree.
Okay, I have a question from Representative Neuberger, then Anderson. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. If you could clarify for me, please. What exact data sets, what exact data are you going to be looking for in this program?
Representative Wagenius.
Madam Chair, under the conservation measurement tool that the department will be developing, we will look at what are the practices that are being installed on a particular farm. So, for example, the buffer strips, the grass waterways, what kinds of tillage practices are they utilizing? What kinds of nutrient management plans do they have in place? There's a number of different practices. And then we will be looking at what kinds of best management practices need to be installed in order to reach a level for certification. And so we would be collecting that data to determine whether the producer meets the certification criteria under this program or not.
Further questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Neuberger.
I do have concerns about this program, and especially about this particular data. I've met with I come from a rural district, and I have met just last month with farmers in my district that are very concerned about the state's overreach, especially when it comes to water usage and our riparian water laws. At this point, because you're telling me that the data sets that you're collecting, it's rather vague at this point. If you're talking about nitrate usage, if you're talking about how many gallons of water they're going to be drawing from the water tables, there's what this looks like to me, that this data is going to be used as an initial way for the state to control farming. I just need to have more. I have a lot of red flags that are going off because of my meetings that I've had with my constituents. I haven't heard anything. What I'm hearing is all coming from the state. We're hearing their side of things, but we're not hearing anything from the Agricultural Committee about what data exactly is going to be used and how it's going to be used in the future to further micromanage farming. So I have some very big concerns about this.
I represent Morganius.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I would answer the water data use is already public data. So if you drill a well and it's of a certain size, then that's already public data. And your permit is a public already. I think this is a more narrow band of things that will be kept private in your management practices.
Representative Neuberger, then we have Anderson, and members, we are going to finish the bills today. So if we don't finish them before our committee adjourns in 15 minutes, we're coming back later today.
All right,
so Representative Neuberger.
Thank you. I'll be quick. The water monitoring is, at this time, it's not complete. And if farmers, agricultural producers want to drill, right now there's a voluntary program, it's my understanding, to drill monitor wells. No, it's not. It's mandatory at this time. It's becoming that, and they have to foot the cost themselves. What has been explained to me is the way that the water monitoring is going, is that this is kind of a backdoor way for the state to really micromanage. And that's a huge concern for the Agricultural Committee, especially with the data that's coming from this. So I really want to suggest caution as we move forward with this.
Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morginius, I come from a mostly rural farming community or district, and I stay pretty much in contact with my farmers. I had six people down here just yesterday, and we were covering about everything you can imagine that's in front of us this year for egg type bills. This was one of them, and the reaction that I'm getting from my people is they just want to be left alone. This is another program that's very invasive to them, and that's what I'm getting from my constituents. So my question to you is, what are your constituents bringing to the table in this issue?
Briefly, Representative Wagenius, because then we're going to vote.
This is a voluntary program. No farmer has to join into this program that doesn't want the advantage of the program. It's a totally voluntary program.
All right. With that, the chair renews her motion. That House File 11.
I'd request a roll call on this, please.
Okay. Representative Neuberger requests a roll call. The motion is that House File 1175 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Government Operations Committee as amended. The clerk will call the roll.
Chair Hillstrom.
Aye.
Mr. Allen.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Hortman.
Aye.
Representative Howe. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling. Representative Neuberger.
No.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Pugh.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
Yes.
Representative Scott. Representative Winkler.
Yes.
Representative Yaruso.
Yes.
The motion prevails 8-5.
Thank you, members. I appreciate it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Holberg.
If I might, This is a really important issue, and I don't think we can do it in 10 minutes. And so I'm happy to come back, but given the amount of interest, the pace of this committee, the complexity of this issue, if the bill author, being a member of the committee, might maybe continue till Friday and give some people some time to work on this, I think that'd be a much better approach than even trying to slam through something later this afternoon or tonight.
Representative Holberg, it's my understanding that Representative Hortman has a doctor here to give testimony, that we are going to be laying the bill over, and that we're going to come back. We just need to make sure we get in some of the testimony for folks that are here.
All right, thank you.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, I have a handout, too, for the page. Sorry about that.
And Representative Portman, your bill needs next to go to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy.
That's correct. But I think there's some work we need to do, and most of the work is with regard to data. That's the big issue in the bill, and I think that work is more properly done in civil law and the people who know data practices the best. So, members, House File 824 is a bill to improve data sharing between healthcare providers. And Representative Huntley asked me to carry this bill. He's kind of the guru on health and human services issues around here, and I was happy to do it. Both Representative Huntley and I have had family members in recent months in medical care, and having a situation where the provider in the emergency room needed data that was somewhere else and critically needed the data that was somewhere else and didn't have access to it. In Representative Huntley's case, and in my case, our family members were fine, but the situation was made much more grave and stressful and chaotic because of a lack of information about prior treatment that had been given. And in my case, it was about getting emergency room data to a neurologist about a brain injury, and it was critically important. And I would have happily signed the release and... But the fact was the release wasn't there, and so the neurologist didn't have the data from the emergency room about my relative's brain injury. So, members, in the interest of improving patient care, I think we have to work on the way we handle data in a more complicated electronic environment. The difficulty is balancing the rights of patients to get good care and doctors to have the information they need to make right decisions, and patient privacy. And we want to protect data and make sure it's cared for properly and not shared with entities that the patient would not want the data shared with. And with that, Madam Chair, I have Catherine Commit here to describe what's in the bill briefly, and then we have a doctor to provide some testimony.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Catherine Commit, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And I want to say that the Council of Health Plans supports this legislation, as do the other large health care organizations such as the Minnesota Medical Association and the Minnesota Hospital Association. And I'll be very brief because I do want to have the testifier come up to the table. But this bill essentially aligns authorization that's in current law with what the federal standards are in our federal HIPAA laws. And Minnesota is one of two states in the nation that has a stricter standard. And while that is always good for protecting patient data privacy, it also, the reality is that it is also a barrier for providers to be able to clinically share appropriate data with each other so that they can better manage the care of the patient and so that the patient has a better outcome. We are not talking about doing anything here that would that would harm the patient in any way. The same law, the same protections, the same enforcements would be in place. It would simply make it follow the federal standard to be able to share patient data between providers and other elements of the healthcare system. So with that, I'd like to just turn it over to Dr. Ryan Else. He is here from Mercy Hospital.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Ryan Els. I'm the Vice President of Medical Affairs and a practicing internal medicine physician at Mercy Hospital in Coon Rapids. Mercy Hospital is part of Alina Health, a not-for-profit network of 11 hospitals, 90 clinics, and other specialty care services like pharmacy, ambulance, and home care. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. Simply put, HF824 will help Mercy provide better care to our patients. Mercy Hospital is a 271-bed facility that serves the Northwest metro area. We are the fourth busiest emergency room in the state, seeing nearly 60,000 patients every year, patients who may already be within the Alina system, and many who come from across the state and around the country. Due to the intensive needs of many of our patients, there are different health care providers involved in their care. The hospital is just one of a group of health care providers a patient may see. Right now, we are unable to share critical information about treatments the patient has received at Mercy with the outside providers the patient sees after a hospital stay in an efficient manner. And the reverse is true, and this is the part that really frustrates me the most. We cannot easily see what treatments the patient has had from a provider outside of our system. Sharing clinically appropriate data means the patient receives better care. Alina Health has one of the most comprehensive electronic medical records in the country. The quality and speed of care I am able to provide to Alina patients is amazing, as I can see every test they have had done in the past 5 years within an Alina facility. But that does not help me or my patients when they have been treated at another health system. Just yesterday, I saw a 53-year-old patient at Mercy who came with chest pain concerning for an impending heart attack. This patient said he had been treated at another hospital in Minnesota in recent months, but couldn't remember which one. All I could tell from our record is that it wasn't within Alina. If we had real-time access to his complete medical history, we could have avoided doing a complicated, expensive, and risky medical procedure. Nearly every day, I'm ordering lab tests, expensive imaging studies, or simply admitting patients to the hospital for observation. All of this is oftentimes redundant. However, I have no way of knowing this without having access to more health information. I have dozens of other examples similar to these where better information would lead to better, cheaper care. HF824 will also help Mercy Hospital lower the number of people who are readmitted to our hospital after being discharged. In my experience, the leading cause of patient readmissions is that the post-hospital follow-up with a physician after the patient has been discharged does not go as planned. After sharing and reviewing clinically appropriate data, providers will be able to understand why someone was hospitalized in the first place and take steps to prevent the medical condition or mental illness from declining to a point where the person must go back to the hospital. Preventing readmissions is in the patient's best interest. Another example of risks with readmissions is this. Despite every healthcare facility's best attempt at providing a safe environment, certain infections do live in these environments. The less patients are in a hospital, the lower their risk is of acquiring one of these potentially deadly infections. It is also better for healthcare payers, including the state of Minnesota and hospitals, that are much more often being held accountable when patients are rehospitalized. Hospitals are increasingly being held accountable for patient outcomes. Quality scores and payments are negatively impacted when readmissions occur, but this is only one example of that accountability. Healthcare delivery is changing. Models called total cost of care mean a group of providers get paid a lump sum to care for a group of patients, and we bear the responsibility for their health outcomes. This is a good thing for patients and for the healthcare market in general. It means patients will get better quality care at lower costs. But it also means we have to be able to share clinically appropriate data in order for the patient to get the most benefit. HF824 keeps HIPAA protections in place. Patients will still give consent to have their records released. The difference is they will not have to give consent each time a provider needs to see a medical record for treatment purposes. Allowing healthcare providers to share information more efficiently will be better for patients. When a patient is ill and needs additional care, the last thing they want to do is focus on paperwork. The patients and their families want to focus on getting better. Furthermore, for every administrative dollar the healthcare providers spend pushing unnecessary paperwork, the resources available for actual patient care are less. Doctors want to treat patients, nurses want to treat patients. But the requirements that are currently in place in Minnesota force healthcare providers to divert time and energy away from patient care. This legislation allows hospitals and other providers to focus on helping patients get better. One final point that I need to make today. Updating the laws that govern patient data in Minnesota will not result in the elimination of medical privacy, as some opponents of this legislation have claimed. There would still be substantial protections in place for patients. Hospitals will still be required to establish internal policies and procedures necessary to keep patient information private. We will still be required to notify patients about their privacy rights and to obtain authorization to collect and use confidential information. We will still train our caregivers so they understand the importance of patient privacy, and we will still ensure patient records are secure and inaccessible to those who do not need to have access to the records. Even when all these safeguards are in place, privacy mistakes may still occur. When we make mistakes related to patient privacy, healthcare providers will still be required to notify patients of our errors, provide protections for patients to limit the negative consequences of data breaches, such as credit monitoring, and we will still hold those employees and contractors responsible for data breaches accountable for their actions. Hospitals and all care providers understand that patients trust us with their substantial personal information. We are not interested in doing anything to betray that trust, but we need to remove artificial barriers that limit our ability to provide high-quality coordinated care. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just real briefly, I know we're going to spend more time on this, but do you believe a patient should have the right to control who has access to their medical records?
Representative.
Ma'am?
Go ahead.
For me?
Yeah, go ahead. Doctor, I couldn't remember your last name.
Doctor Else, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It's a very tricky question because we see patients oftentimes that are unable to speak for themselves at the time we see them.
Well,
Representative Holbrook.
Well, Madam Chair, if I might, maybe I should preface. Should an individual of sound mind and not have mental or other issues be able to control who has access to their medical record?
Doctor Else.
Again, I will actually say that's a very complicated question. I'll explain why. We see patients that are drug-seeking all the time. Many would argue they're of sound mind. If we can't see where they've been, if we can't see the care we received, we're unable to figure out how to treat them. And so, again, I'm not trying to be complicated here, but it's really hard.
Well, Representative Holbrook.
Madam Chair, should public policy take away rights of people for a small minority to address that issue? I mean, your example about drug seeking, we have all kinds of other things, prescription drug registries. I mean, in Minnesota, at least historically, we put a high value on individuals' medical records and their control of those records. Now, maybe that's going to change with new people in charge this year, but I understand that it's somewhat cumbersome, but I hope that in Minnesota this isn't going to change, that we recognize and support an individual's right to control who has access to their medical records.
Members, the doctor's not coming back. Any other questions for the doctor? We're going to be laying this bill over. All right, Representative Portman.
Thank you. I just wanted to briefly respond to Representative Holberg because I do agree with you that individuals have the right to control their medical information, and I think that we can achieve a balance where we make sure that individuals like me who want to make sure when somebody very close to them has a neurological problem that needs immediate treatment, that the doctor has all the information that doctor needs to properly treat that close and important relative. And I think Ms. Kmit just had a brief response.
Thank you. Members, we're going to lay over House File 824. And then, members, we still have one bill left to do. That's House File 909. We're going to do that after the break. We're going to be in recess. I have to chair the Judiciary Committee immediately after session. That'll be like 5 minutes, and then we'll do this committee. So we'll recess to 30 minutes following session in 400 North. With that, this meeting is in recess.
House Civil Law Committee is called back to order. House File 909, Representative Dabney.
Good evening, Chair.
Good evening, Representative Dabney. The Chair moves House File 909.
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Okay, to your bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, House File 909 replaces and updates the current parenting education requirements in cases of divorce when minor children are present. It explicitly identifies standards for parenting education programs, reduces the requirement from 8 hours for the parents to 4 hours by strengthening those program standards, and the hope there that by reducing the demand in half will actually encourage and increase completion of the parenting education requirement. It places an emphasis, in the words of the bill, aimed at increasing the parents' sensitivity to children's needs and giving them skills to improve the parents' and the children's adjustment to the dissolution of the marriage. Much of the bill before you is simply a restating of current law in a different way. I have two testifiers with me this evening. Ms. Ray is a family law attorney, and Mr. Tom Pritchard of the Minnesota Family Council.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Ray.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Judge, Bruce Peterson of Hennepin County Bench was here this morning, was not able to return this evening. He did provide a written statement. Do you wish to have that read into the record? Do you want this simply distributed to members? All right. If a page could magically appear over my left shoulder, that'd be perfect.
Thank you. Ms. Ray, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Linda Ray. I am and members of the committee, I am a family law attorney in Edina, Minnesota. I've been practicing family law since 1995, and I've represented over 1,000 family law clients. I'm concerned about the impact of divorce on parents and children, and I believe the bill before you can make a big difference in their lives. This bill can significantly improve the prospects for parents' compliance with the parent education requirement over current law, and it can improve the prospects for better co-parenting following the divorce. First, the bill requires that all parents take the class. We know that even in cases that settle, parents can benefit from divorce education. Second, the bill requires that the education programs meet acceptable standards of scientific evidence demonstrating effectiveness in reducing parental conflict and improving children's adjustment post-divorce. Third, parents' compliance with the education requirement within the first 30 days of filing is increased because the court must verify that the parents have taken the class at the first court hearing, which is usually the ICMC, Initial Case Management Conference. And if the class has not been taken, the court is to set a timetable for taking the class. Fourth, with the advent of online parent education courses, taking the course will be much more convenient, and therefore it's likely to increase the compliance rate. Parents no longer have to wait for a class to be offered. They can take it on their computer or go to a library computer and take the class. Parents in outstate Minnesota, rural Minnesota, don't have to wait months for a class to be offered in their locale. Fourth, education program requirements include not only a heavy emphasis on constructive parenting, but also mandate an inclusion of a module in the class that deals with resolving family law disputes out of court, including mediation, collaborative law, and cooperative law. Finally, I'd point out that the Minnesota Bar Association has not opposed the bill in any way, and if the affirmative support of the family law section would be helpful to enactment, that can be requested. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. Mr. Pritchard, please step forward, state your name for the record, Mr. Pritchard. I'm sorry, you know what I should ask? Other questions of members of the committee for Ms. Ray? Okay, thank you, Ms. Ray.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and I'm here to speak in support of Representative Dabney's bill. This bill isn't creating a new requirement in state law. What it does is strengthen and make more effective a provision in state law which deals with divorce and its impact on children. Obviously, there's lots of pain and heartache divorcing persons go through, but it's not just for adults. It also impacts children, probably at an even deeper way. This provision is designed to help divorcing parents realize the pain and difficulty divorce can bring into the lives of their children and how to effectively work to mitigate it. For instance, divorce puts children at higher risk for behavioral problems, depression, school failure, substance abuse, and a range of other problems. And a lot of research shows that remarriage and stepfamily life comes with a new set of challenges for children. This provision is designed to make parents aware of these potential consequences for their children and learn how they can help their children through the process. So I support Representative Dabney's efforts in this bill to improve an important provision in state law designed to help parents and children. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pritchard. Questions from members of the committee for Mr. Pritchard? Okay, hearing none, then Representative Dabney, anything else you wanted to say about the bill?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present the bill this evening. Ask members for their support so that the bill can move forward.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only question is and I'm not sure if I'm asking the right, if the author's the right guy to answer this, but my concern is how do we verify the requirement if they can take this online? And I fully support the bill. There's, but my concern is if it, if you can take it online, how do we verify that the person that's supposed to take it is actually taking it?
Representative Dabney.
Interesting question, Mr. Chair.
I'm Ms. Ray, however, is here to save me on this one. Yes, because Representative Howell, that is an issue in online education. Who's behind the computer?
Well, Representative Howell, as a military veteran with a number of actual online things we have to take. Certificates. Ms. Ray, go ahead.
And this is probably not going to be a satisfactory answer, but the person who takes it has to fill out a form, and at the end of taking the online course, at least the one that I've seen, they will be issued a certificate. So can you have your next-door neighbor be the one to sit at the computer? There's probably no way to guard against that, but you do have to go all the way through the online program to get your certificate at the end and put your name in.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as you well know, we're well attuned to taking a lot of online training. So my question is there a way to solidify that in some way to give them an ID number that they got to punch in order to take it? Because my concern is if two of them really want to get divorced and one person says no sweat, I'll take care of it all for you and punches in the numbers and they know the number, they know the, probably have access to a lot of different things, but if you'd issue a number to them and maybe make it a little bit clearer that they have to, that it's them taking it. My concern is you know, if they're not really into getting the information and actually going through the program and one of them just does it for both, I think we could. So that's what my suggestion is maybe tighten that up a little bit and provide some way to bring that together because you know, for us we put in an access card and punch in an ID code and we're in, but I don't think that's fiscally feasible to do that for everybody. But I just offer that and try to bring some clarity. But I definitely support what you're doing.
Thank you, Representative Howell. Representative Holbert.
I was curious, and I think I figured it out, but I just want to clarify. You said it wasn't much different than current law, but in looking at what's being repealed, it looks like currently this is only required in contested parenting cases. Is that correct?
That's true. Current law only requires, there's some discretion, and judges do require parenting clauses in contested cases only. For cases that settle, there is no parenting clause requirement.
And this one's going to require it of every single person that has kids, minor children.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Yes. Any other questions from members of the committee? Well, seeing none, then, members, we're going to collect individual members for a vote, so the committee will be in recess until we get members down. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're going to do, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, what did you say?
We're going into recess to collect members for a vote.
Oh, collect. I thought you were going to collect the votes for members. I'm like,
we'll be good.
Process here.
Are we
good? Yeah, we're good. Yeah. We'll be good. We were naughty this morning. We'll be good tonight.
And this is going to Judiciary. All in favor of House File 909, that'll be recommended to pass and be referred to Judiciary, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay.
Charlotte,
thank you,
she
Mr. Chair,
has tennis shoes on, so she's really glad.
They're comfy, I can get around.
Yeah. There being no other business before the committee, committee is adjourned.